You're listening to In Technology, your source for trends about security, sustainability, and technology.
I think the biggest question that will always stay in the space of side channels is, how can I prevent the practical exploitation of a side channel while not losing the efficiency gains that I get from sharing the resource?
Hi, I'm Camille Morehart, your host for In Technology podcast. I recently had the opportunity to speak with two world-famous hackers or offensive security researchers, Daniel Gruss and Anders Fogh. These two have a history together focusing on side channel exploits. And we're going to get more into what those are and some of the new threats that they pose. But first, a little bit more about my guests. Anders Fogh is a fellow at Intel and a security researcher known for his work in information security, optical media, including DVDs, and reverse engineering. Daniel Gruss is world-renowned for having implemented the first remote fault attack running in a website known as rowhammer.js. Interestingly, Anders was the first person to suggest a software-only solution to the Rowhammer exploit, so you see how they got to know each other. And back to Daniel, his research team was one of the teams that found Spectre and Meltdown in 2018. Spectre and Meltdown are some of the most important hardware vulnerabilities ever found and exist in vast majority of CPU architecture. Daniel's team also designed the software patch against Meltdown, which is now integrated into virtually every operating system that exists. Okay, as an entry point to discussing side channels, I think we should revisit Spectre and Meltdown and the work that Daniel and his team did. And I wonder, Anders, if you could kick it off by explaining to us why what Daniel and his team did matters and why all of us should have at least some kind of a grasp on what it is.
While Daniel wasn't the one to find Rowhammer, he has been a protagonist in showing the possibilities of Rowhammer, which is one of two new instances of classes of issues that we have had for a very long time. And the other one, Daniel literally was one of the people that founded and paved the way for it as well. If you think about the last 10 years, those are the two new bug classes that we got, and Daniel was heavily involved in both.
Oh, that's so nice words. I would be a bit more humble. I mean, especially for Meltdown, I always like to emphasize that Jan Horn actually was much earlier than we were with discovering this.
So what actually happened? Could you take us back?
What happened back then? Several people were looking in a similar direction. From my perspective, all of this started in 2016-17 when I was looking at the prefetch instruction. This was actually, I think, the second or the third time that my research collided with what Anders did. He was working at a company in Germany back then, and he was also looking at microarchitecture and instructions and so on. But for prefetch, that was interesting. We used this software instruction on the kernel memory, and somehow it did something on the kernel addresses. And that was very interesting. And from my perspective, that was kind of the start that led to all the things that followed. So it was only a matter of time until someone realizes that there is more things behind that and that you can take more control over the microarchitecture there, as you can do with speculative execution with Spectre. Or if you, instead of a prefetch instruction, really try to read the kernel memory there, that during a very, very short time window, you actually get the data. I think Anders labeled it as the bug was ripe. That is why there were so many people finding it at around the same time.
There was a lot of work being done in that space that set the stage for it. Dmitry Pomanov did a paper on branch predictors, how they were used for side channels. That was my secondary inspiration for working in this direction. My own work with Daniel and the prefetch was sort of my primary. It was getting right. There was too much research that was leading to the conclusion that there would be more. And the missing part of that equation was speculative execution. And we got that in 2017.
So can you guys explain for people who aren't as familiar with it, just at a relatively high level, what is side channel and how is it that speculative execution is then allowing you to get to the kernel memory, which is supposed to be the most secret area of the CPU?
I would say for this part, speculative execution is only part of the problem, or maybe one building block that can lead there. The main problem here was that the processor deliberately accesses the cache, even if the translation of the address results in an access violation. If processor finds out, it's an illegal access. There are still cases where the data goes from the cache line into a register where the pipeline then can continue to use it. If we want to put it in easier terms, if you would go to the library and try to get a book, you are not allowed to access, then the librarian would say, well, you can't get this book. Maybe you're not old enough or something like that. And then the meltdown bug is, they still hand you the book for a very short moment in time. You can take a look and then they realize, oh, wait a second, give that back. So there are consequences and maybe I'm kicked out of the library, but by then I already had a peek and figured out what I wanted to figure out. And in a computer, I can repeat these things over and over and over again. And even if I can only get a very short peek, the computer doesn't realize that I'm doing this all the time and getting one peek after the other.
So you're not downloading information, but you're accessing information.
We're accessing information directly, yeah.
What were all of the factors that were leading the world to think about this kind of an exploit that was driving both of you to be working in this space?
So sidechannels goes back to when I was born, pretty much, so 1974, something like that. It came up every once in a while, but sort of in the mid-90s, people started realizing that this would break cryptography. And there was a whole large literature bunch from 1995 to 2012 about breaking cryptography. But some of us then started asking, what else can we do with this? And Daniel has worked on keystrokes, and I worked on bypassing exploit mitigations, and we're sort of pushing the limit of what you could do with it. And that ended up opening new doors for speculative execution and Spectra Meltdown and pretty much everything that came after it, slowly expanding the area where a known phenomenon hadn't been studied before.
And what is a side channel?
Yeah, there are different definitions of what a side channel is, and I'm constantly fighting against other academics there about the definitions. A definition that I really like is that you obtain metadata, any kind of metadata that is derived from some data that you actually want to have. And although you can't just recover the data from the metadata, because this is a lossy process typically, you still use the metadata to infer the data. For example, if I can take a look at your network packets, I maybe cannot see what's in there because they are encrypted. But because of the size of the network packet, which is just metadata of the actual data that is transmitted, I can infer which website you're visiting, which video you're watching, things like that.
And then from there, are you looking for an easier path to kind of hack in or gain more information about me? Or are you stopping with the metadata?
You extrapolate from the metadata to data, right? So what speculative execution does, it gives you control about what is basically leaked into the channel. And once you have control, you can start putting things into side channels that correlates directly with data. Imagine having me break into your car and read your odometer, right? Now you go for a ride after I did that and come back and I read your odometer again. Now I can start arguing about where you went. Right? So this is when we're going from the metadata on your odometer to actually figuring out where you were.
But with speculative execution, as you just said, you get the control over it. So instead of now just saying, oh, maybe the person went here or there, what we actually then can do for a very short time window, we can say, okay, the secret is a 1. Let's let the car drive for 1 kilometer. The secret was a 2. Drive 2 kilometers, and so on.
I can make you take a different route.
Yes.
Basically with speculative execution. And that allows me much better to say from your odometer where you actually went. Say, you go a kilometer north and then the trip becomes shorter. Well, then I know you went in that direction. If you go south, your trip gets longer and I know you wanted to go north. And that is what speculative execution does for the example, right? It allows me to get you to do detours.
So if you're looking at, just to take a really specific example, if you're looking at the size of a network packet and you're trying to discover, are you trying to discover, say, what website I visited?
For instance, yeah.
How exactly are you honing in on that? And what is the ultimate goal then? Is it to get access to my account on the website or just to know what website I'm visiting or?
It always depends, right? My interest as a researcher or professor at a university is not to hack into anyone's system,
right?
But to show the problems, show what malicious actors could be doing. For a side channel, I would say if I'm figuring out what website you're visiting, maybe that's already valuable information. But it always depends on what I can do with a specific side channel. There might be side channels that I can use to leak passwords or password hashes or other type of credentials, and then use that to gain access to a system.
So kind of moving forward, what are the types of attacks that you guys are looking at now?
I think one point I would like to pick up, Anders mentioned that there was a lot of momentum that was picked up in the 90s and then also in the 2000s. This move from, there are side channels, but no one is using, or only very few actors are using them because it's not clear what they are useful for, towards there are use cases where we use cryptography every day, chip cards, for instance, authentication methods, banking. Then the movement towards the internet. We had the internet where suddenly adversaries have access to millions of machines, to basically every person on the planet if they want to. So the question then is more about the threat model. Why were all these attacks not discovered in the, let's say, 80s or 90s, even if they had existed by the technology? They would not have been relevant because there was no threat model. There was no way to get the malicious code in that scale to the computers that we have today. Today, if I write a malware, it's comparably easy to roll it out to even hundreds of thousands of machines.
Is that because all of the machines are running on the same architecture or because all of the machines are plugged into the cloud or the internet?
I think the main culprit here is the internet. The internet was a mistake, right? We wouldn't have all these attacks. We would have no ransomware attacks if we wouldn't have the internet.
Is there an option to create a second internet that doesn't have the same kind of access opportunities?
I would say no. The entire story is more in the direction of there are only so much we can do for security, right? If you take the analog example, is people have been producing locks for the past, 5,000 years by now, starting with the ancient Egyptians. And people found out how to pick them. And you can still pick most door locks pretty easy. It has gotten a lot more difficult, for sure. The Egyptians' locks were pretty primitive. And that's what we're seeing in the internet as well, right? In the beginning, hacking the internet was not a big deal. And now it's gotten a lot harder, but we're not getting rid of lockpicking.
Yeah. Not in 6,000 years, huh? Yeah, I would agree. Asking about what is the next thing? I think we will continue with this trend of remote attacks. I think we will see more and more remote attacks. And that is the challenge that I would see that we need to tackle. People say remote to a lot of different things. Remote could be someone just sending you network packets. Remote could be JavaScript running in your browser. Remote could even be an application that you installed from a remote server. So there is a lot of variety of what a remote adversary can do and what kind of access it has to your machine.
I think that's true. And I think where SideChannel has had the most impact so far is local attacks. The Spectre and Meltdown are mostly local attacks. For many of the researchers out there, the holy grail is to come up with practical attacks.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that people are there. They're moving in that direction. We'll see what can be done in that space for sure.
Yep.
And what can be prevented.
But in that sense, even Meltdown and Spectre, you could argue, where is this relevant? Of course, if you have a remote adversary, the adversary will not be sitting in your room for that, probably.
True, but he would get local access, have to have access to a computer first, right? So he need a chain of things.
Which brings us back to the question of what does remote actually mean? If I have JavaScript that I execute on the computer, is it still a remote attack? People label it as remote attacks, but actually I have local code execution inside the JavaScript sandbox.
I don't think it's one definition, right? It's more like a degree of remote.
Yes.
Degree of separation, really, right? Mm-hmm. There are many degrees of that kind of separation happening over the internet.
For instance, also in the cloud, on your personal computers, you have JavaScript that is sort of isolated from the rest. And in the cloud, you have these virtual machines that are isolated from each other. It's a pretty similar scenario there. And we are facing the same problems there. This is the other part where side channels have been exploited a lot in cloud scenarios from one virtual machine to the other.
Because the infrastructure is sitting in proximity to itself, and then you have different companies with different information or different individuals with different private information, but in physical proximity.
The story about side channels is a story about shared resources.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So in my example from your odometer before, I had access to your odometer. We shared it. I could look at it, and so could you. And you were using it, and I was looking at it. And from that, I deferred information about where you went. That's sort of the story of side channels. So the more resources you share with other people, the more you will leak data from using those resources.
Now, the obvious solution then is we don't share resources anymore. But that is very easy said, but very difficult to do because resources can be very abstract. There have been side channels, for instance, where you have two computers sitting in the same room. And because of the computations from one computer, how they influence the room temperature, the other computer can sense this change in the room temperature and can infer some secret that was transmitted. In this case, the room is the shared resource. So what do we want to do? Not have any cloud servers anymore with virtual machines on the same server? And then also not data centers anymore, but every server in a separate physical location? It would get ridiculous at some point.
One has to acknowledge that resource sharing, if they're not fully utilized, is economically much more viable than duplicating resources.
Yes.
And that's sort of the high-level point about why we're never getting rid of side channels. We're not willing or capable of just separating everything. And yes, that means that side channels will always be there. That does not mean that side channels cannot be managed as a security problem, right? We got rid of Meltdown. We don't have that anymore. That is basically us managing how we do things, right? So we're not getting rid of side channels, but we can manage them. In fact, I think we can do a pretty good job of managing them.
Yeah.
So what are the key ways to manage them?
I think a lot has to do with control over the side channels. The more control an attacker gets, the more he's capable of figuring out what you're doing. And preventing control is something that can be done. There's control, access control mechanisms that could be done. There is
randomization.
Randomization, noise. There's a ton of things you can do.
There are best studies actually in the area of cryptography, commonly discussed as masking and hiding, where hiding is basically you increase the noise floor relative to the signal or reduce the signal relative to the noise floor. And masking works a bit differently, where you split up the secrets. So even if you leak something, then you would only have half of the secret and you can't do really much with it. Even there, it's still possible to mount an attack. You just increase the costs for an attack, the number of traces, the number of measurements that you need to perform, the amount of time that it takes, even the cost for the analysis, the computation costs. This increases quadratically typically or exponentially than if you go to higher order masking. That's possible, but it's only an increase. An attack will always be possible. And the even worse part is that these techniques are pretty specific for specific computations. And applying that to generic problems that we have with side channels everywhere is not even really clear how we would do that.
That said, there's tons of nuance here, right? So we killed Meltdown.
Yeah.
And that was because we had an implementation that we could change and it would just completely break that particular side channel. So these are things that are very often practical and sometimes not. It depends on the details, the goal of the technology and all these kind of things. And sometimes we can actually completely break these things. But as a general rule, we share resources, and that is the sort of the key problem. Doesn't mean that we can't manage them and sometimes, in some cases, kill the worst of them, right? And that's what I spend most of my time with, killing side channels.
Can you guys talk a little bit about your expectation for how introduction and increased use of AI is going to change, I suppose, the threat landscape across software and hardware?
I think we're repeating the same mistakes that we did in the past. We decided at some point that it's super convenient to mix code and data together in a computer system and not separate those. Now we're doing exactly the same thing again. We're mixing code and data that we send to these AI systems. They are being used already by websites in the background where you can query AI chatbots. And suddenly, commands and data are in the same channel and under the control of the user. We've been there. We had done all these mistakes. Here we are, and we're still suffering from the decisions back then.
I think there's lots of nuance on what AI is going to do. So AI is going to enable finding bugs more efficiently. Mm-hmm. And that plays to both sides of the equation, right? The attacker is more able to find issues that he can use, but the defender is too. There's a large economical question in it, right? And I think Microsoft is capable of investing significantly more in AI and AI security technologies than, say, your average exploit vendor. That said, NSA will have very significant capabilities on their own, right? So it de-democratizes hacking, right, to some extent. Mm-hmm. What the net result is, I don't know.
I mean, is the best defense sort of the offense, like you were saying, Anders, of just generating noise and using AI to kind of generate additional information or additional noise? How do you start to defend against it when you have AI-level attacks?
I don't think AI will find fundamentally different attacks. AI is not generating something fundamentally different from the inputs that we provide to it, even if it can do variations of it and even quite creative variations, if you want to call it creative. But still, all of this, like if we are training a neural network to produce language, it will produce language that sounds like the language that was fed into it. If we feed into it how to find bugs, how to build attacks, then it will find similar bugs and attacks. And it will do so much more efficiently than humans. That is what I would expect. But it won't be able to find bug types or bug classes that are completely different in its nature. There have been many attempts also in academia to build systems to find new bugs. Fuzzers have been very popular. And they mutate the inputs, they mutate the test cases in a way so that they can come up with new exploit chains that then find new problems. But then again, if you run these fuzzers, after some time, they don't find a lot anymore because they covered all the area that is there to find. And then for the new problems, especially if you take a look at side channels, if you have a fuzzer that can find one type of side channels, it won't necessarily find other side channels, and most likely it won't.
I'm not sure that AI is going to be such a big game changer on security. I think mm-hmm. in some areas of security, surely, sort of finding the bugs that we do know. We have to realize AI in itself adds very, very significant new complexity, like 4 billion parameters in a model and adversarial attacks on that model as well. It adds a whole new set of insecurity to the world as well.
Yes. Especially as we connect these to the internet now. Mm-hmm. I mean, ChatGPT can access web servers. I'm not sure that's a good idea. I just tried that out with my own web server, and I tried out which queries do I have to send and what is the maximum frequency with which I can reach my own web server from ChatGPT. It can really live access this web server, but it needs some convincing.
So what do you think, Daniel, of LLMs or generative AI? What is going to be the approach to attack it? It is shared resources for the most part.
Yeah, but shared resources, the thing is, the largest part of this LLM is very static, right? This is trained by the company. And then, of course, they will still tweak a bit here and there. And the larger part is they will retrain the model at some point and generate a new version. We've seen attempts to attack these, for instance, by poisoning the data, by providing incorrect data that is hidden from the human eye. But then the LLM learns that and believes that is the truth. Sure, we will probably see that. Maybe that's the new form of search engine optimization. Can call it LLM optimization then. My company is the first thing you will find if you enter a related query on ChatGPT. Sure. But the question is, what does it really change?
So in your opinion, should enterprises be adopting LLMs or is it make them too vulnerable?
I think yes. I think they should. But at the same time, we will have new kinds of employees, probably same as we at some point got quality assurance. We will then have also more quality assurance for this part.
I heard some very interesting takes on LLMs doing programming. And the take is that the difficult part of programming is not writing the code.
Yeah.
And that's what people spend most of the time with this today. And I think that will be taken over by AI. The question that is really important for writing code is, what problem am I solving? And what does the solution look like? And being very specific about that is what people struggle with all the time. Right? This is where we have the bugs come in, right? This is not the people not being specific about what they actually want.
Yes.
I don't think that LLMs are capable of helping there. How should an LLM know exactly what it is that I want, what I'm thinking of? That's the key limitation of LLMs, if you ask me. This is not just a gold rush without gold. There's gold to be found with LLMs, but it is not a panacea. It will change the world, but some fundamental things will not move much.
But then again, the most precise way to specify what you want as a programmer is to write down the code.
And you'll find very often you don't get what you want.
So if resources, or you guys were saying a lot of shared resources are essentially what led to the exploration of side channels to get additional information, shared infrastructure. And you talked about this is just economically the most viable approach right now. Are there other approaches in development where would the pendulum sort of swing back, but in a new way with like machine learning where people are kind of having their own models in their own location with their own data sort of sequestered?
It's the entire story of compute, really. We went from IBM saying that 6 computers is enough for the entire world till everybody has a computer on their wrist, and went back from that to, hey, let's use the cloud computer of which there are, 15 large providers or something like that, right? It goes back and forth all the time. If you think of it, the cloud is a great way to suppress side channels because an attacker does not only need to have a side channel, he also needs to find you in the cloud.
Yeah.
And that's a big problem for them. There's thousands and thousands of machines in the cloud, and finding you on those machines is a very, very significant problem.
Yeah.
Side channels are one of these beasts. It's an emergent property of compute, really, and of many other things too. There's no rules or anything they follow, and they are rarely considered at design time. And this means that they change as technology change. And when we see how a real quantum computer looks like, we can start speculating about what the side channels are. And it could be better, it could be worse, it could be all kinds of things. We just don't know. We're starting to learn about what side channels in current computers means and how we can minimize their impact. And we're getting good at it. But the side channels in computers were not designed with them. Those are emergent properties of other things like, hey, we can share resources and make more efficient and cheaper computers.
I think this is a big and relevant point. It's about efficiency also. Efficiency always has the economic component, but also looking into the future where it's expected that compute will consume more and more energy, predicted to be around 20 to 25% by 2030. We have this big problem that we need to improve the efficiency. And how do we do that? By sharing hardware more efficiently, by sharing resources more efficiently. And that inherently opens up new side channels, new problems. This is not necessarily bad, but there has to be this constant battle between making things better in a way of efficiency in economic terms, and at the same time, taking care that security still is at a reasonable level. And this is a constant battle. We introduce the internet. Okay, that means we also need to do more for security. We move everything to the cloud. Okay, then we also need to think about what security means here. With every level that we introduce where we share something, we need to think a bit more about security.
So what are the most important questions that researchers should be asking right now?
I think the biggest question that will always stay in the space of side channels is, how can I prevent the practical exploitation of a side channel while not losing the efficiency gains that I get from sharing the resource? And it's not easy to answer, not generic to answer. This is always the thing. When we find a new side channel, we have to ask this question. How do we stop it without losing everything that we gained?
There's polarities to be managed in this space, in security in general. And everybody is doing it and don't like to talk about it, but that's the reality of things. That ransomware became a thing because of internet, but that doesn't mean the internet is bad. Should we figure out how we can do an internet where ransomware plays a lesser role? Absolutely. But it's a difficult job, both technically and politically and in all dimensions. And side channel is a microcosmos of that.
And will we ever reach an internet where ransomware is not possible? I doubt it. Still, I think we're moving ahead. We're making it more difficult for ransomware to spread. We're making it more difficult for people to develop ransomware. This is a slow process, a slow progress that we make there. But as Anders said, rolling back the internet is no real alternative.
So what do you get excited about right now, Daniel? What are you working on late at night these days?
Well, I'm now a head of a research group. Well, the last two nights I was busy with correcting exams, 200 students in an information security class, which is also something I sometimes also talk about these things with my wife. And we are asking, okay, with what do we have more impact, with our research or with the teaching? And we both agree that actually with the teaching, we most likely have more impact on society, because these are hundreds of students every year that we train, that we show how they can build better systems, more secure systems, what best practices are out there to build complex systems. And I think that's the bigger impact. So correcting exams, writing grant proposals to fund my research group. Then what else do we have? Yes, managing the group, of course. There are people in the group and they have different needs. They need support with paper writing, maybe support with some other administrative tasks. There are all kinds of things to manage.
Well, what is your goal? Is it having an impact on society? What's your ultimate goal?
I think in the end, life is just a very short movie. And you want this movie to be nice to watch afterwards. And having a positive impact on society would be one aspect. And you can have that, for instance, by educating people. There is this thing that a lot of people say, I want to leave the world in a better shape for my children than I found it, right? We are doing a pretty, pretty poor job at that. Very, very poor job at that. We're leaving the world in a technology-wise, much better situation than before, maybe. But overall, we are creating a lot of problems that we are not solving. I want to bring knowledge out to the people. And this can be knowledge in forms of education or knowledge in form of research to the community.
Has that always been kind of your driving force, or is that...
For a long time. I realized that I really like to teach already in school. And then during my studies also here in Graz, they have a very nice setup where when I was in the in the third semester of my undergraduate studies, I was already teaching smaller classes with like 30, 40 students, which is very nice. And you can learn teaching with that. And at some point when I was finished with my master's, so I did a bachelor's master's, I went to the head of the institute where I was at and asked him, okay, so I really like teaching. Can I please continue? And he was like, no, you can't. You finished your master's. You have to go to industry. I was like, yeah, but there are these older people here also, not the professors, but in between, and they still do some teaching. And he was like, ah, you mean the PhD students? That is the worst motivation that I ever heard to start a PhD. I started a PhD and it worked out well. And that's how I got here.
How old were you when the internet came in and into your life? And when, like, how did you get your start? Did you have grow up with computers all around you all the time?
Yeah, a bit. So I'm born in 1986 and we always had computers already around when I was in primary school. At some point we had a C64, we had a 386 then. But at some point, I think that was around 96, 97. That's from that point on, I had my own computer and I could do a lot of stuff there. And then 97, 98 was then when I also had access to the internet and had it since. So maybe the age of 10, roughly.
Oh, I didn't even make it to my 20s until I got internet. I started with bulletin boards. And what would that have been? 1992-ish. So that was 50, but it wasn't internet just, well, the internet existed, but wasn't on it.
It's kind of the internet.
Was the real precursor for the internet, really. So I've been a computer nerd pretty much as long as I can remember. My dad was sort of the original generation of computer nerds. He still tells the story about how great it was with his first calculator. So it's just been a part of my life always. Just grew up with computers.
And you grew up in Denmark, right?
Right.
I have a little bit of a non sequitur for you guys. As we start housing more of humanity's critical infrastructure off the Earth, right? I look at satellites and, you know, we're also looking to build permanent base on the moon so we can do further space exploration. How do you see securing that environment or mitigating a problem that might occur in those kinds of environments?
Yeah,
that's really two questions.
Yes.
The first question I would say is, how do we protect it? And that's about protecting the links, right? Nobody's going to take a trip to the moon to break into a computer, but there will be some kind of link to use the computer on the moon or wherever it is. Right? And that's going to be a challenge. I know people that work on satellite security, and you don't just reboot a satellite, and that makes for a lot of problems. So that's going to be a real challenge. The other is the environment. The environment are very hostile to how computers work. There's large temperature swings. There is a lot of radiation out in space. Those are really the enemies of computers, and we're going to need to fundamentally redesign some of the things that we do in computers to make it happen.
I think this sort of aligns a bit with security. At least I'm trying to do that. Maybe I haven't convinced Anders yet, but one thing that we are trying because of, we have these reliability mechanisms in computers already for a long time, for instance, error correcting codes. And I believe that we can do a lot more there with security. From my perspective, we had reliability mechanisms for a long time. And the typical threat model is, let's assume a standard scenario, no adversary. We assume there can be this many bit flips, but not more than that. The way the assumptions are made are completely different than in security. And in security, we try to approach this more principled. Let's assume the worst case. What is the worst case? What is the probability that someone succeeds in that case? And I think a bit of that thinking could also help in those scenarios. If I know that the probability that even an intelligent adversary will not succeed or will only succeed with a super low probability, then I think we can also benefit from that in situations where there is no adversary.
I think of reliability as a subset of security.
Yes. Yeah.
I think.
But don't tell that to everyone. Some people really hate that statement.
For sure. I think Rowhammer is the thing that really hammered that point home, right? That if you can't rely on the components in your computer, you can't rely on your computer.
Yes.
But in the end, it's going to be a question of probabilities, right? The sun has a sunstorm and the radiation climbs above what is reliable, and then weird things happen.
Yeah. And they have more specialized hardware up there, that is clear. But even in that situation, I'd rather have a system that doesn't continue with corrupted memory and takes a bit longer for the computations than the other way around.
We've been talking with Anders Fogh, Intel fellow and security researcher, as well as Daniel Gruss, professor at Technical University of Graz and also a world-renowned hacker. We've been all over the map with security and vulnerabilities and anticipated vulnerabilities. Thank you both so very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you too.
We hope you'll join us for the next episode of In Technology. In the meantime, follow Camille Morhart on LinkedIn to continue the conversation. That's Morhart, Morhardt. Thanks for listening.
The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and author and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Intel Corporation.